to another episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts, just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an aerospace and airplane nerd from the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I am Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And we are deep into the minute. We are 12 minutes into the who'd have thought it would have gone this long? 12 minutes into the movie. Let's just go over briefly what's going on here in the in an alley in Brooklyn, outside of the theater. Bucky Barnes helps Steve Rogers to his feet and says, "Come on, man, it's my last night, and I got to get you cleaned up." They head out of that hallway, that alleyway, and wind up at the mysterious 1943. World Exhibition of Tomorrow, and Steve is going to get hooked up with a couple of girls from another franchise, and we end with a souped-up Cadillac, and Iron Man's dad is going to be coming out and talking about the future. So, guys, what a fun-filled episode, and of course, it is something that is close to our hearts, no matter how fictional it may seem. This is a obvious stand-in for the 1939-1940 New York World's Fair. Brian, do you
yes.
have anything to say about the 1939?
Well, let me share my bona fides. I wrote a graphic novel called Whatever Happened, World of Tomorrow, that the entire first chapter happens in the 39 World's Fair. So I wouldn't call myself a World's Fair expert, but I would call myself a passionate aficionado. And the 39 World's Fair, the real World's Fair, not the 43 Stark version of it, was just a watershed in American history and how I think people, particularly Americans, viewed the future. It was a lot of people's first glimpse at things like a fax machine. They had a fax machine in 1939, television. They had all these technological wonders. And millions of people went to the New York World's Fair. They all went in with a different vision of what the next 3, 4, 5, 10 decades were going to be like. And they all came out with the same vision of this technological utopia of these 12-lane freeways driving into cities with towering skyscrapers, all white and lit up. And it was just an amazing vision of tomorrow. The fictional 43 World Exhibition of Tomorrow is a mirror of that, and actually combines sort of some of the look and feel of both the 39 World's Fair and the 64 World's Fair, which was in the exact same spot as the 39 World's Fair, and also had its own historic iconography and importance in American culture. But in my mind, the 39 World's Fair is when America went from its agrarian past to its technological future. I think that's the line that divides that.
Agreed.
Absolutely.
Definitely part of it. And still a beautiful, I think is a beautiful simulation of, as you said, both World's Fairs. We have a Unisphere-like globe. Somewhere in the distance, you can see Manhattan. The buildings are rather tall for being out in the middle of Flushing, Queens. But it really does capture the spirit, if not the verisimilitude of the fair.
It really felt like you were there, and the excitement of the people and the you know, the costumes, the MPs wandering about and all of that. I thought the MPs were a nice touch because it tells you that it's 19, in this case, 43, and there's a war on. So there's soldiers about, and Bucky's going overseas.
And, you know, that's something that I found myself thinking about quite a bit is, you know, wondering how would I think it probably wouldn't have happened, but how would the 39 World's Fair have been different if it did happen in 1943? You know, as in 39, you've got the world on the brink of war, but, you know, back here in the U.S., it's not that real to us at that point. And it is all about that optimism. Brian, do you think it would have been tempered? Do you think it would have had that unbridled forward looking, everything's looking rosy, had it taken place actually during World War II instead of on the eve?
My opinion, probably not, because they just wouldn't have had the resources to throw a party like that. It would have all gone to the war drive. But even in the 39 World's Fair, Every nation had its little pavilion where you'd come in and learn about the culture and the food and have a beer in the German pavilion and so forth. In 1939, the real World's Fair, the Poland pavilion, it got canceled because they'd been invaded by the Nazis. Czechoslovakia, pavilion was not there because they'd been invaded by the Nazis. So even in 39, although the United States was not directly involved, you see the impact of the war on the European nations, who couldn't show up to the fair because they'd been invaded by the Nazis. And I think that curve, that arc would have continued. But the bottom line, I think your question's an interesting one. I think they probably just wouldn't have had anything like that because you couldn't get all the nations of the world together at that time in that place and thrown what must have been, the equivalent of $1 billion into this party.
Yeah, trying to sell your red points to get hot dogs at the fair, I don't think would happen in 43. So it would be a little bit difficult to get some food there. But an interesting, I mean, it really is not how the past happened, but it how the past felt. I think this is how it feels looking back 80 years later and saying, yeah, I think this is what it would feel like, even though it's rather a romanticized view. But again, we're living in a comic book. As we'll keep coming back to this in every episode, that this is not real. It's a comic book. Speaking of comic books, one of the little details in the midst of all this, we're looking at an exhibit of Dr. Phineas Horton presents the Synthetic Man, which is just done in passing, but it's a beautiful Easter egg for comic book aficionados. And Brian, I'm sure you have thoughts on that.
Oh man, this minute is the only reason you asked me to co-host this podcast. I'm sure of it because I'm about to open up a can of human torch on you.
Yikes.
Real android human torch.
Marvel Comics number one came out in our reality in October 1939. The very first issue, the very first Marvel comic, shows the Human Torch melting his way through a wall. And the Human Torch was an android built by Phineas Horton, went on to be a hero through World War II, and disappeared in when a lot of superhero comics disappeared in the mid to late 50s because they were bad for children. It turned out, everybody thought, during World War II, comic books, superhero comic books sold millions and millions of copies. And in the 50s, that market just crashes. People got scared of them, kind of like, 20 or 30 years later, parents would be scared of by video games. It was the same kind of panic. But in any case, the Human Torch was Jim Hammond. And there are drawings in the comic books then and now of the Human Torch, the synthetic human being in the red leotard in this test tube in Dr. Horton's laboratory. It looks just like that. And particularly, it looks like some artwork from a later book called Marvels by Alex Ross and Kurt Busiek in
Oh,
1994,
sure.
which retells the whole story of the Marvel Universe as if it happened in real time. Like in 1939, here's what was going on in the Marvel Universe. But the artwork is beautiful. It looks like Norman Rockwell painted it. It doesn't look like comic book artwork. And so this image in the movie of a man in a red leotard in a test tube is taken right out of Marvels by Alex Ross. It's beautiful. Now, I got a deep dive for you. This is
Okay.
the deep track on the B side. There's another Marvel Comics and Cinematic Universe character called Vision. He became an Avenger. He was in Scarlet Witch and the Vision television show. And the Vision was introduced to comics in 1968, Avengers issue number 57. A few years later, in Avengers 93, writer Roy Thomas had Ant-Man go inside the Vision, shrink down like Fantastic Voyage, because there was something wrong with the Vision that the Ant-Man had to shrink down, go inside the Vision, repair and fix up. And while Ant-Man's inside the Vision, he sees something. We don't know what, but he sees something, says, "Holy cow!" or something equivalent. It turns out, years later, we learn that the Vision was the original Android Human Torch was refurbished into the Vision.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
That the Vision, or that the in the 50s, the Human Torch was put in stasis, basically buried in a concrete crypt. 20 years later, Ultron dug him up, refurbished him, gave him a good scrubbing, turned his skin red, and turned him into what we knew as the Vision. Now, that was later retconned into other things, so I don't know if that's still true comics universe-wise, but it was a really neat Circle, done by writer Roy Thomas, because writer Roy Thomas loved these Golden Age characters from the 30s and 40s. And he took every opportunity he could to drag them into the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So this was his way of taking this Human Torch that he loved and giving him a fresh coat of paint and turning him into this entirely different new hero. So that's my deep dive. If the Marvel Cinematic Universe hewed to the vision of the comic books, that guy in the red leotard in the test tube in Captain America would have later become the Vision. Now, we saw the movies. We know that's not how it happened. But if they'd been consistent, that's how it would have gone.
That's just incredible. Now, I feel like I'm going to have to turn in my nerd card here. But since you've opened the door, what was, if any, what was the relationship and what was the path to get from Phineas Horton's android Human Torch to Johnny Storm and the Fantastic Four? Any connection there, or was it just sort of a recycling of the name?
Yeah, not a narrative connection. There's no connection between their powers and anything like that. We all know Fantastic Four went into space and got cosmic raid, and that's how they got their powers. I think it was just probably in the real world, an instance of Marvel in the 60s saying, hey, we got this character, we got the name, we got the rights, we want to keep the trademark and the copyright, let's just make a new character called the Human Torch. I suspect that's exactly what Stan Lee was thinking in, you know, in 62? Was it 62 when he created the Fantastic Four? It was like that. And I think that's why they brought back Captain America. And there was an, you know, Marvel had the rights to an android, or not an android, a character called the Vision in the 50s. They brought back a character called the Vision. So there was a lot of this churn. The same thing was happening at DC, where there was a 1950s Flash and then there was a 1960s Flash. Totally different characters, and not uncommon back in those days.
No, he can't keep a good guy down, especially when he's on fire.
So. No, he flies when he's on fire.
That's true. Yeah. Wow. I do. You know, I every time I've looked at this minute, I've watched it a couple of times before we did this episode. Every time I look at this, I just want to live at the World's Fair. It's one of those things. When I was 5 years old, my dad built the fountains that are underneath the Unisphere that exists now for the 1964-65 World's Fair. And so it's kind of like I feel a personal connection to that World's Fair, because it's kind of one of my dad's monuments. And seeing it in a movie, you know, in the next century is rather it's very sentimental for me, because I kind of grew up with that globe. It's nice being able to focus on how much of a, you know, not just for people who visited the fair then, it's so iconic, the image of, as you were saying, the future of being able to be seeing, instead of looking backwards, looking forwards. Mm-hmm. And I keep wondering, if we have that forward look now, what is the forward? What icon for us is the forward look today? Where do we see?
Well, you know, my opinion is, one of the themes of my book, Whatever Happened to the World of Tomorrow, is our society from, say, the 30s through the 70s went from a technological utopianism where we all thought the future was going to be great and flying cars and Jetsons, to sort of a more technological dystopianism where the robots turn on us and we're, you know, we went from Flash Gordon to Blade Runner. And I think that sort of, that dark view of the future is probably more ascendant than ever these days. But I mean, you know, AI could be the best thing that ever happened to us, or it could just destroy us all, and we don't really know, but we're just kind of blithely going along anyway. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a mix of in between. I mean, we were picturing, you know, everybody having a jet pack and getting around, but we know how people drive, and we'd rather not. And, you know, I think applications that we can't even think of. I mean, who would have thought when we were kids, who would have thought that you'd be able to carry around a device so you could watch top run, you know, recent run movies on your lap in the bathroom? It's just, you know, it's one of those things that you never expect where the technology is going to lead. I mean, to me, I think about stuff like automated driving, driverless cars and things like that. People say, well, I want control of my own car. But when you think about it, if you're 90 years old and you can't see out of one eye, and you still need to get to the grocery store and things like that. Well, you can either have your car drive you there and you load up your groceries as you want, or you could send your robot out to go pick up groceries. I think those are the things that we're going to see, not in making the world a little bit easier for us. I think that's where the future is going to lie. It's the most unexpected of places. It's basically getting you out of the misery that you don't know you're in right now.
Right. If we had, if we each had a crystal ball, then we'd be, buying stock in something or other, and get rich and retire and move on with our lives. But the thing for me that has always resonated so strongly about World's Fairs and why I fell in love with your book, Brian, and sent you a fan letter that led to all of this indirectly. Was the idea, as you said, we went from agrarian to sort of technology based. We went to, but that idea of looking forward, and it doesn't, to me, it never mattered how many of those sort of predictions turned out to be right, how many turned out to be wrong. It was the attitude that said that we can be optimistic, that the power of sort of innovation and creativity and rational thought is going to make things better. Now, maybe it looks like this. Maybe we all have a kitchen made out of a single piece of plastic that we clean by hosing it down, as we saw in the old popular science news
And
reels.
nuclear power too cheap to meter.
Yes, exactly. Too cheap to meter nuclear power, all those things. And like anybody else, you sort of chuckle at the ones they got wrong, but I stop short of mocking the attitude behind it that just says that people are capable of great things. And if there's an environment in which people are allowed to innovate and allowed to create, then cool things are going to happen. And Jim, as you pointed out, it's not going to never going to go quite the way you expect, because none of us can see the future. But when I find myself sort of wishing, as you said, I wish I could live at that World Exhibition of tomorrow. I wish I could go be a tourist at the 39 Fair and the 64 Fair. And I have to call out the 62 Fair in
Ah,
Seattle with the
yes.
Space Needle and all that stuff where I proposed. All of those things that it's that thinking that I miss the most, even though I didn't experience it firsthand. That's what I yearn for.
I think it's there. It's a lot of times though we don't hear about it. In the it bleeds, it leads categories of media, you don't hear about amazing things that are going on in the background. I have a neighbor who has a college-age daughter who just presented a paper about a proposed satellite that would orbit Mars and measure gravity changes. And what they were doing is, with the specific gravity of the planet over a specific area, they're looking for mass concentrations in Mars that would equal water ice. So the very concept of here's, I mean, I can't think of her as a kid because she's of age, but here's a young person thinking about the future, so far in the future that they're thinking, how do I find water ice on Mars with satellites that haven't been built yet? And it's that kind of attitude with young people. And Hal, I'm sure you meet people at EAA that young kids with drive and you want to learn about the future of aviation and aerospace and things like that. Anytime you're down, remember that there's always people like this who are trying to think further into the future than
Right.
even we are.
Absolutely.
Hear,
And
hear.
they'll be doing that, I hate to say it, but they'll be doing that long after we're gone. Unless the
Hope
singularity gets
so.
here soon and we're all heads in jars, podcasting 100 years from now, Futurama style. I don't know if either of you guys ever saw a documentary. It was on HBO probably 25 years ago. It was called Yesterday's Tomorrows. And it tied into a Smithsonian exhibit, and there's a companion book. It was just, one of the earlier sort of mainstream looks at the whole concept of retrofuturism, which I know we all have affection for. And it was really interesting. There was so much of that that I loved, but then I remember they interviewed John Waters, and I don't I don't have any
future
really,
John Orth.
Yeah, I don't really have any. Although I, yeah, after that documentary, I started describing myself internally as noted futurist Hal Bryan, but it didn't take. But
you couldn't get anybody else to go along.
Yeah, somebody's got to note me. But anyway, we talked to John Waters, and I didn't have an opinion on him one way or another. But he was the one who was looking back at all these predictions and all these inventions and ideas and things. And he was just gleefully discrediting them. He was so excited to say, oh, they were such idiots. They thought things were going to be good. What a bunch of total morons. And he was just vitriolic and celebrating the things that didn't come true. And that, I think, you know, that cemented that sort of opposite feeling in me, that it's like, okay, so your prediction of this technology wasn't right, but darn it, you were optimistic. And you were looking for ways to do things better, but
yeah, we weren't fools for shooting for it.
No,
amen. Here.
Things like, I mean, we're just talking about nuclear energy too cheap to meter, but when's the last time you worried about how long you were hanging on a long distance call? I mean, here we are talking for free, coast to coast, and in many, you know, we're using up a lot of bandwidth, but it doesn't really matter because it doesn't really cost anything.
Yeah. We should have done this after 8 when the minutes are cheaper and everything else.
That's fast. Actually, that's a really good point. And we're sitting here, the three of us, spread all across the country, and we're doing this podcast. It's amazing. Right.
We can see each other just like the magic video phones of the early 60s.
And tens of people are listening to us. So
literally tens. Yes. You want me to name them all?
Yeah. wives and siblings don't count. I had one narrative note that's one of my favorite moments in the movie. I didn't want to let pass in this minute, and it's about 13 seconds in this minute where Bucky's picked Steve up in the alley and he slaps a newspaper in his chest and Steve says, "Where are we going?" And Bucky says, "To the future." And the first 300 times I saw this movie, I thought, well, that's a fun bit of foreshadowing because, you know, Steve's going to the future. And it just occurred to me in preparing for this podcast, Bucky's going to the future too. They're both going to the future. One way or another, Steve gets frozen and Bucky gets, Russianified. And it's just such a neat little bit of foreshadowing that just passes quick because you think, well, yeah, we're going to the World Exposition of tomorrow. We're going to the future. But those two guys are literally going to the future. And I love that.
You know, that's funny. I always thought about that with Steve, but somehow never with Bucky. You know, that's absolutely right. And boy, and that, just that next scene, as we've said at the beginning, that the Unisphere, that monorail, you know, I wanted to climb into that scene. I just want to pause it. I want a whole movie where that's just, you know, Bucky and Steve and the girls cruising around the exhibition. Nothing happens. There's no fights. Just show me everything, please.
I want to see the smoking robot. That's the
yes, exactly. Yes,
I do. You know, just before we go at the end of the very end of this minute, we get to see that that hover, which we're going to talk about in the next episode. But that hover car that Mr. Stark is about to show, and I keep wondering. We need to find somebody in the production manager or something to find out. That has to be a real 1941 Cadillac. Which is a gorgeous car. And I was just hoping that after they finished with it, they took all the prop hover devices off and put it back together because it is a I love the old style C-body Cadillacs from that era. They're so big. And Brian, I would imagine they'd be fun to draw. Lots of curves. And
now, you know how they did that, Jim. That was like a 75 Vista Cruiser. They just slapped a fiberglass shell on top of. Come on, man.
Oh, stop it, you.
the dream wrecker.
We didn't bring you onto this thing to,
you know how
to
make,
us
get made.
Make us depressed.
Yeah. It's all CGI. Vista Cruiser. Yes. Well, on that note, I want to thank everybody for joining us. If you'd like to continue the conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. And if you do like our show, please don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics, all the stuff we've been talking about, and our guests. So be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.